Well, we always try and take a national view here on the King Review, so it's absolutely fantastic to have a chat to my next guest. He is on the line from beautiful northern New South Wales. His name is John Anderson, of course, the former Deputy Prime Minister. John, welcome to the King Review.
Terrific to be with you.
Now, look, lots of things I want to talk to you about. You're a keynote speaker at a Landcare Week online conference happening this week. But first of all, let's cast our eyes across the nation, obviously particularly on the political front. Interested in your take on the vaccine rollout. Lots of criticism, lots of mixed messaging. It seems like things are starting to pick up now. How would you rate the vaccine rollout over the last 6 months or so?
Well, look, I think it's easy to apportion blame, but probably all of us have been lulled into the sense of security or a false sense of security by the fact that we've kept infection rates so low in Australia for so long. And we still don't know all the reasons as to why we've been relatively immune. It's not just that we're an island nation. There'll be other factors at play. But I think a false sense of we've got this under control was ignoring the fact that it's always more dangerous in winter. And now it's got away, and maybe we've gone a bit too far down the road of saying to people, we can eliminate this. That was never, in my view, going to be possible. At some stage, we're going to have to face the fact that, like the flu, you can't insulate everyone, even with vaccination, from this. That's a hard reality of life. Life isn't always the way we'd like it to be. It's now really important, though, that people take the vaccines, and with great, I suppose, respect, as politely as I can say, I have to say that I don't share the view that I know is promulgated in Queensland that you ought to be careful if you're younger about AstraZeneca. I don't pretend to be a scientist or a doctor, but I do say this. Britain has now come out of lockdown. They've had their so-called Freedom Day. It seems at this stage to be going very well, and it was done mainly with AstraZeneca. The inventor of AstraZeneca is a national hero over there. Because it's produced such good results. I honestly believe people should think very carefully about how quickly they can get themselves vaccinated. The sooner Australia's vaccinated, the sooner we can end these very damaging lockdowns, not least of all because they're going to saddle our kids with horrendous debts.
Well, John, there have been some disgraceful comments, I have to say, from the chief medical officer there maybe a month ago about AstraZeneca, where she really just, there's almost this scare, fear-mongering that she was on about AstraZeneca, saying that she doesn't want an 18-year-old to die if they were to get the AZ jab.
Well, I think your chief medical officer is quite isolated. And I don't think there are too many people in the scientific or medical or even political world who agree with her. But let me put it to you this way. On my understanding of things, to be consistent, she should say, well, I'm going to recommend, I don't want an 18-year-old girl dying because she's on the pill, because it's actually far riskier.
It
the
is.
Chances of getting a blood clot from being on the pill are far higher. So is she going to be consistent and say that in Queensland we don't want girls under 40 going on the pill? We've really got to take a broader view here. We have every national interest, and particularly if you're worried about young people, in getting the economy going again at every level. Because the psychological and the economic impacts of lockdowns are very high indeed.
We've had Prime Minister Scott Morrison announce this roadmap, or the targets at least, out of this COVID nightmare. Something like 70 to 80% need to be vaccinated before the states and the feds can agree no more lockdowns and easing a whole range of restrictions. That seems very ambitious to me, given what are we at, about 15%. Are you confident that Australia is going to be able to get to some of these targets and talking by the end of the year, November, by the or end of the year? It seems like a long way away.
I agree. I think we have to try. Can I say that? I think we've got to be ambitious and we've got to try. We really do. This has gone on too long. I keep harping back on it, doing too much damage to the interests of our children and grandchildren.
Now, I'm speaking here, of course, with John Anderson. You'll remember the voice. John, your political future. You had a crack at the Senate there in New South Wales for the Nats. Can we see you back in politics at some point?
No, I think that was probably the final seal, I have to say. It's not something I wanted to do. I'll be really frank with you and your listeners. Politics is not a lifestyle that appeals enormously to me. But I'm deeply worried. I really am. I think Australia's in great danger. I don't want to sound, it's because I love the place, but I've got to be honest and say, I think we're in grave danger. I think the chances of a global economic meltdown, particularly post-COVID, the debts that people have built up, the breakdown in trading relationships, the possibility of very high inflation, of interest rates rising, and then the whole alignment now between the emerging sort of authoritarian bloc of nations and the democracies is really threatening for Australia. And, well, I'll say it. I don't believe the National Party has been filling the available space on behalf of regional Australians, because in the end, we're Australians first. We're patriots like everyone else. And traditionally, the party's always been active on those fronts. And I felt that it could be more active and I could help it a bit. That was not the judgment of the Central Council in New South Wales. They chose a former state director. That's how these things pan out. But I won't die wondering whether I should have at least offered.
Are you happy with Barnaby Joyce, the move to Barnaby Joyce as leader?
Look, I'm very. Well, the thing I would say, having just said that, I think the National Party needs to fill the available space. I think it has an opportunity and a responsibility to speak very clearly to these major national issues in the federal parliament. And Barnaby's been very clear and very strong. He plainly understands that. Can I put it this way? We're all focused on zero emissions by 2050. We need to be focused on whether or not Australia can operate as a free, independent land of opportunity in 2050 in a very different world as well. There are no guarantees. The world is an ugly-looking place. Frankly, we've been far too slow to learn the lessons of the last decade. We don't even have our diesel reserves in place. I'm staggered by it. Well, we've got around 23 weeks' supply of diesel on shore. You know, we're signatories to an international agreement that we'll have 90 days. And I know there's a plan around, I don't know whether I'm meant to know it or not, but there's a plan around to at least double it at a cost of $1 billion by putting three major storage tanks for diesel in the east and two in the west. Well, where is it? Anything could go wrong at any time. You can't just conjure these things up out of thin air if something goes wrong. And then there's defence. Well, you know, what has happened to this once proud nation that we could make such a mess of acquiring new submarines, which are the ultimate deterrent for a mid-range power like us? What has happened that we're now in trouble with our frigate contract? It just needs a greater sense of urgency. And I say that because I believe in freedom. And I grew up with a father who was almost killed in the North African desert during the Second World War. And he abhorred war, and he gave me the same abhorrence of it. And I've always felt that, you know, the old RSL logo is right. You know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, and we haven't been vigilant. Mm-hmm. So that was my motivation. And to be fair to Barnaby, yeah, good on him. I mean, he's spoken up about these things. I dare say he'll push hard around that cabinet table.
When you reflect back on your time in the leadership of the leadership of the nation, in fact, what's different about that era compared to now? And I say that, you know, Prime Minister Scott Morrison comes under a bit of flack, Scotty from marketing, and he doesn't really stand up for anything. What's different, do you think, about the leadership at the time that you were there leading the country versus today? Is it just that the world has changed? What's changed? The ingredients of our political leadership, what's changed in your view?
I think a lot of things have changed, to be honest. I think society's changed. I think we've become very self-centred. An author I read the other day, he's written a book, said we've become psychological man. I feel, so I am. We feel we should be looked after. We feel we're the centre of our own universe, if not the universe. We feel government should be there to look after us all the time. You're seeing that a little bit with the COVID thing, I think. We need to get back to thinking a bit more about our neighbour and our community and our nation. I think that's a problem at one level, and I think it's made worse by social media. I don't say social media is the cause of the problem, but it's amplified the problem. And the way in which we can tear one another apart now, if the PM sets out a vision, you know, it's immediately pulled apart, sometimes on the grounds of emotion, not clear thinking. We need to think more clearly. One One Queensland LNP figure that I really do respect said to me the other day that, you know, he always felt that he knew exactly what sort of Australia the two Johns, by which he met John Howard and me, believed in. Mm. I think that's important. People want to know what sort of society our leaders believe in. Mm. I believe in a nation that is free, and I think we're losing sight of what freedom is.
Absolutely. So does that mean then that we can't have the type of leadership or the things that you and John Howard did back then can't be done today, in a sense, because all of those factors have changed? We've changed as individuals. Social media is now dominating the space.
I think it's very hard now, but I actually think if we were awake in this country, we'd realise that whether you come from Townsville or whether you come from Tamworth, whether you, whatever pronoun you put in front of your name, whatever the colour of your skin, if you're an Australian, the things that should be uniting us and the things that should be driving us to defend our freedoms far outweigh the things that we're tearing ourselves apart. We are in a struggle now to make sure that we remain economically strong and a land of opportunity for young people. The cost of housing, the possibility of interest rates starting to rise again on the economic front, the risks of the global trading environment, they're a real worry for it. We've already seen agriculture hit. But then there's this whole saber rattling from up north, which is really very worrying. You can't get away from it. So we should be focused on the things that we have in common. We all want a strong and free country. And so I think the thing that I would say is that the sooner we unite as a people and put our differences aside, the sooner we'll be prepared together to make some of the tough choices that are actually needed. And we do face tough choices. The last major reform in Australia, you could argue, where there was a full-blooded debate and then a hard thing was done, was probably the new tax system, including the GST, 2000. Well, that's 21 years ago. And now we've got some really big issues confronting us that can't all be solved with money. Many of them need national unity and they need less bickering on social media. They need a greater sense of national cohesion and commitment to one another. We can't just think of ourselves all the time.
Well, it begs the question that perhaps we can't have those big reforms anymore for the very reasons that you speak about, that things get torn down before we even have a chance to have a rational and measured debate about them. Now, John, the real reason for the call, apart from some fantastic insights from you, is you are a keynote speaker at the Landcare Week conference. It's an online conference. Tell us a little bit about why Landcare is still important and a bit of an overview, a bit of a preview of your keynote speech.
Well, thank you. Landcare, and of course, the trouble is that I can't do it in person, and we're all getting a bit zoomed out.
Yes.
So, unfortunately, it's a webinar because of what's happened in Sydney. But yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to speak at the Landcare conference. I think overwhelmingly land managers care passionately about the condition of their land, and I think they are the original environmentalists. Mm. It's a big statement, I know, but I really believe that. And part of what I'll be saying is that I was conscious from an incredibly early age, you know, just how much most of the farmers in the area that I live in, because I've always lived in the same place, actually cared about their land. Now, our technologies have changed. The way we care about it and our understanding and the way we look after our lands changed a lot. But one of the major accelerants of the whole process, I think, was Landcare. And I can say that, you know, with a spirit of some generosity, I hope, it was actually an invention of the Kerner government. Not that I admired it very much. Mm. Kerner Labor government in Victoria. But then Bob Hawke and John Kerrin, the year I went into Parliament in 1989, launched Landcare. And Landcare and the symbol, you know, the hands holding Australia, sort of cupping Australia, are recognised by something like 80% of Australians.
Mm.
And huge numbers of Australians involved now, not just land owners and managers, but people living in coastal areas, looking after dunes, people all over the country doing their bit to clean up whatever. And the other thing is that our understanding of our soils, Australia's a leader in this area, that's exploding as well. Mm. So we're now starting to understand that farmers are, if I can put it in simple language, recyclers of carbon. Now, everyone's talking about carbon. We emit carbon producing food. In fact, feeding people around the world probably produces around 30% of emissions in total. But we're also absorbers of carbon. And if we can just keep minute extra amounts in the soil for longer, it goes a long way towards this objective of reducing emissions and locking up emissions, pulling emissions out of the air, if you like, CO2 out of the air and storing it as carbon. More than that, it actually gives you higher quality, denser foodstuffs in soils that are tired. So we're learning a huge amount. Part of what I will be trying to say tomorrow is that it depends heavily, of course, on government leadership, just as then Prime Minister Hawke and Ag Minister John Kerin launched it in 1989, right through to this day. It's always required strong Commonwealth leadership. And I think David Littleproud deserves plaudits for seeking to make sure with his national soil strategy that that tradition's been continued.
John Anderson, absolute pleasure to speak with you. Your insights are very much appreciated, and I hope that you weren't serious when you said you won't have another crack at politics. I think we need you there. We need you there in some capacity.
Well, you might have to go and talk to a few of the central councillors in New South Wales if they decided they didn't.
John Anderson, amazing stuff. Thank you so much for your time today on The King Review.
It's been a pleasure, and all the very best to you and to your listeners. I look forward to the day when I can go to North Queensland again.